Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 260. What are the advantages of using pollers for your Python data projects? When should you use the lazy or eager APIs? And what are the benefits of each? This week on the show, we speak with Jeroen Janssens and Thijs Nudorp about their book, Python Pollers, the Definitive Guide. Jeroen and Thijs describe how they were introduced to pollers while working at Xomnia. They were converting a large data project to Python and saw surprising speed increases using the new library. We discuss converting projects from pandas to pollers, getting away from indexes, consistent syntax, and using lazy versus eager APIs. Jeroen and Thijs share multiple tips for using pollers in your code. We dig into the process of writing a definitive guide and the advantages of working collaboratively on a book project. They also share resources for practicing data wrangling and building visualizations with PyD Tuesday. Hey there, I've got a quick request. We've created our first Real Python Podcast listener survey. We're trying to learn more about you, our audience, and what you're interested in us covering on the show. It's a quick survey, less than 5 minutes. You can click the link right in the show notes on your podcast player, or visit realpython.com/podcast, and the link will be in the show notes for this episode. Thanks. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, I want to welcome Jeroen and Thijs to the podcast. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hey there, Christopher.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Excited to talk to you. It's been a little while. We've been kind of going back and forth for a little while between the springtime conference seasons and other stuff like that. But I'm excited to talk to you about pollers. I had somebody on the show to talk about pollers a long time ago. We talked to Liam Brannigan. The episode was called Speeding Up Your Data Frames with Pollers. But that was back in episode 140. And so we're a couple of years past that. And so lots happened in the world of pollers. It's been very interesting. Maybe we could start here. One thing that you mentioned is both of you worked at an organization that had a little bit to do with pollers there, and maybe you can kind of talk a little bit about that background if you're comfortable. I don't know who wants to start that off.
Sure, I can kick that one off because I'm the one of the two that still works there.
Oh, cool. All right, Thijs. Okay.
It's Xomnia. Xomnia is a data science, they call it like a boutique, more the custom-made data science solutions in Amsterdam.
Okay.
And that's where Jeroen and I met. It's where Richie Vink, the creator of Pollers, used to work.
Okay.
Back when he started the project until it became very much his own thing. So it's the birthplace of all of this.
There you go. Nice. And Jeroen, you used to work there also.
Yeah, that's right. I started there about 2.5 years ago. And that's also the first time I came in touch with Pollers. I wasn't assigned to any project yet, so I had some time on my hands, and I decided, let's try out this thing. I wasn't really sure what it was, but I heard good things about it.
Yeah.
And then as soon as I tried it, I was hooked. And the same is actually true for Thijs. When I got assigned to a project, it happened to be the project where Thijs was already working.
Oh, okay.
And I mean, we can talk a lot more about this, but that's also how we get started by putting pollers into production.
Yeah,
it's a longer story that I don't know if you want me to share it right now.
We can dive into it because you did a YouTube. Well, there's a clip of a conference talk. I forget where the conference was. Maybe you can let me know on that too.
Was it the Pollers Meetup? Probably the first Pollers meetup.
That one, but also PyData New York.
It's on the PyData site. Yeah, PyData New York. Okay, with the recording that I have. You might have redone it or something, but where you were talking about this, and it's very interesting to kind of dig into it. But that was a large project that you were working on, and was it one of the first times of like really implementing Pollers in a big project like that?
Yeah, I think so. I think this was the very first company where Polaris was put into production, actually. But that wasn't the assignment. The assignment wasn't like, we want you to implement Polaris. No, it was, we were dealing with this huge code base that was essentially a glorified ETL pipeline.
Okay.
Right? There was were a lot of data sources involved, and it was implemented in both Python and in R. And on the Python side, it was all pandas.
Okay.
So it was definitely hurting performance. And this, especially since at a certain point, management from that, from our client, right, they came down to us and say, hey, we want you to, you know, the computations that you do now twice a year, we want you to do them every week.
Oh, okay.
And not just for these 30 networks, right? This was related to the electrical grid in the Netherlands. Not just 30 networks, 30 neighborhoods, but all of them. So over 3,000. And this is your budget, which was about 5,000 euros that we had. So we really had to change things. We had a big problem there because the process was not only slow, it was also using over 700 gigabytes on a single machine.
Whoa.
And so it was also very expensive.
Okay.
Now, Thijs and I, we were aware of this thing called Polaris.
And Richie was working on.
Exactly. And it didn't hit version 1.0 just yet, but we felt good about it. Now, you can imagine when we suggested this to the team, and the team at that time was like three people from Xomnia and four people from the client itself. You can imagine if three people there just suggest like, hey, let's use this package that is being developed at Xomnia, right? Where we come from.
Yeah.
And let's rewrite your entire code base. You can imagine that they weren't so happy about that. So
yeah, we're stoked to try this new thing out.
Yeah, and they're like, we're stoked.
You haven't used it? They were not as stoked.
Yeah. But Thijs, maybe you can say a little bit about the strategy that we then applied.
Yeah. So it was something that both of us had already played around with a little bit. And at Aliando, they work in the safe framework. So every quarter is kind of chopped up into different sprints. And at the end of it, you've got some space for innovation.
Hmm.
That's exactly the time where I just started playing around with translating a bit of our pipeline into Polaris, because it's very easy to jump from pandas to Polaris and back.
Yeah.
So I just benchmarked some very simple transformations. It was just like relatively simple, downloading a file and joining it against the data set and doing some applying some business logic to it. And we swapped that from pandas to Polaris. And in pandas, it ran for about 30 seconds. And Polaris, it took 1.2 seconds. And that's kind of the point where you saw the team go, oh, wait, so maybe this Polaris is more than just like a marketing gimmick that somebody applies to their clients. It's something that has real merit. Yeah, it's one of those things that we've talked about that lately about other tools that we may mention as we go, like UV and so forth, where you just sort of like suddenly go, wait, it's done?
Yeah.
Which is sort of like shocking, you know?
Yeah, I think I had exactly that same experience with also one of the other Astral tools, Rough, when it came out.
Yeah.
That it just formats and lints your whole thing just within the second. And you're like, wait, did it? And you just start editing your files to add like extra spaces to see if it actually formats it at all. And everything just jumps back.
Yeah. I talked to Charlie Marsh a little bit about that.
Nice.
It's kind of crazy. Yeah. Well, cool. In that process, were you then sort of streamlining and pushing this more directly all into Python? Because you said you kind of had a mix of tools. I worked in a marketing sort of data science job, and we had a similar thing where like half the shop was really kind of R fanatics and other people were like Python, you know, people. And often I would get the tools from both of them. And at the time, this is 6 years ago, it was a little hard to try to get one to run on the other or even to convert it. And so you ended up just sort of running separate processes. In this particular case, was there a big deal of like sort of changing it over, or was that easy to do?
So I think what originally was just a pile of R scripts.
Yeah.
They had like a massive server that they ran RStudio on premises. So they had a lot of RAM to spare. So they didn't really have to think about all the software engineering behind it.
Okay.
And we're just able to pick like, okay, so at Thursday night, we get this time frame, we just run everything and we don't have to think about how much RAM it costs. But then as we started porting it over to Python, I think there was just a movement within the company to go towards Python. I think it was a combination of things, but one of the things was also that there's just more software engineers available in the Python world, whereas I think R still sees it most used in the academic world. And I wanted to make the shift to getting stuff into production, thinking more about keeping things monitored, safe, and because it's a power grid provider. So
yeah.
So they tried to make that transition. And what started with like Pandas was the go-to at the time. It's like the data frame library you use if you're working in Python. They had like this interface of RPy2 in between to kind of switch between Python and R. Because this whole data pipeline has all these different phases that we just started translating one by one to also keep a check on if the data that we were outputting was still correct and to put some tests on it, make comparisons.
Sure.
So that's, as we went along, we translated parts of that program to Python and at the time Pandas, but eventually it became Polaris as well.
Okay. It sounds like a big part of this is you're getting information from all of these, you mentioned neighborhoods, and then I'm guessing it kind of expanded across to much more than just individual neighborhoods, like into like across the country. So in that particular circumstance, are you getting different formats of the same data because like maybe they're using different equipment and it's sending it in. And so is it stuff like that?
That was standardized, luckily.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah.
I can give a little background on what the calculation was.
Okay.
Because Alejandro, so it's a power grid provider. They both have a network of gas and electricity. Mm. And the electricity is kind of divided into the three different tiers. Like you have the high voltage lines, which you can usually see running across the landscapes. It's like those high metal towers with cables suspended on it.
Okay.
And the medium is kind of the transportation to neighborhoods, which is usually already underground and happens in these tiny little boxes, these transformer houses. And then the last part, which was our focus, is the low voltage net, which goes from those neighborhood boxes to the house. So it's like the last copper cables running through the street to your house.
Okay.
And for that low voltage network, because of the trend of electrification, of electric cars, of heat pumps, of solar panels, there's a lot more demand on those tiny cables that were practically made for your water cooker and your oven. And a Tesla pulls 10 times the amount of power. So it needs a lot more.
Yeah.
So to help to prioritize the networks for this transition, we try to simulate what would happen if certain neighborhoods would adopt electric vehicles or solar panels heat pumps. And based on, like, we would plot that over the years, like that the adoption would grow and what it would do to that specific network. And then we just compare it with some business rules, like some cables can only take so much capacity. And after that, they just start heating up. They get too hot, they burn through, you get disaster eventually. Yeah. And we don't want that to happen, of course. So the whole point was that we, for all these neighborhoods, we'd make all these translations and simulations to figure out when they would go over certain thresholds so we could prioritize these networks on which we would have to focus first and which would come later.
Okay.
And in the process, you get to do all kinds of things about choosing which kind of fixes you can apply to the network. Because sometimes you can keep patching up a network and replace this cable and then come back a year later, replace that cable. Hmm. But there's other more significant fixes that you can apply, like splitting the network in two and creating like a whole extra feeder point, an extra transformer for the neighborhood, which is way more rigorous, but then you won't have to come back for the next 30 years, for example. So that's the kind of stuff you can play with to optimize it.
Yeah, yeah.
So the underlying data problem is relatively simple. It's just like adding these yearly power usage profiles and just adding them together and applying some business rules to see if they go over certain thresholds.
Okay. And so the idea is here that you're going to need to upgrade the equipment across all these different neighborhoods and sort of prioritizing who's using what. And then I guess part of that also, solar can kind of go both ways. I don't know if they're using it to go back into the grid.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting to see that sometimes it will cancel out because the solar peak is very much during the day, of course. That's when there's the most sun. So you put the most power back into the network. But also, if you have power usage, like people charging their car at home, it will kind of suppress that peak and could play with that too to have all kinds of different charging techniques to see what it does to the network.
It sounds like a really interesting project. How did Polaris help you with that? Like, what was the thing that made it easier than using Pandas? Like, what were some of like the immediate like sort of wins that you felt? We mentioned the speed already, but are there other things that kind of like are related to that you feel like this is a reason people should look at this more. Mm. And hence why we're going to get into the book.
Yeah. So Polar's, it's subjective, but what many people say is that the code is easier to reason about.
Okay.
Yeah. There's nothing happening in place. You use the syntax is more explicit, right? There is no more usage of brackets, right?
Yeah.
When you're writing pandas code, there are a lot of brackets going on. There are no surprises or fewer surprises. And when something does, so especially in terms of converting data types, yeah, that's something that that pandas can do automatically for you. And that's
surprising, maybe.
That's surprising, and that's something you don't want, you know, right? Yeah. You want your ETL to be as boring as possible.
Yeah.
And when something is wrong, you get an error straight away, not after 20 minutes of computation.
Hmm.
So that makes it easier to reason about, easier to debug, it's faster. And, you know, and it's also fair to say that, of course, it was a giant rewrite. So we had the opportunity now to really think well about, okay, what is it that we actually want to accomplish here? What are the transformations of our data? And so that's always that you get a second chance, and that's always easier, right?
Yeah.
Rather than, okay, let's build something for the first time and then bolt on these different features and requirements. And so, I mean, yeah.
You use this term ergonomic in some of the stuff I was reading about, and you've addressed some of that already in talking about that. I think that's really interesting. Also, this idea of you're able to sort of refactor the code as you're working with and use the advantages of Polders here. Did it change like the amount of code that you had to write, or did it change other things that kind of made, like you mentioned, the not needing to use brackets. We'll talk maybe about indexing a little bit as we go, or the no need for it. But, you know, maybe talk about that a little bit more, like the idea of like, okay, well, how does this thing become more ergonomic? And, you know, did it help you like reduce the amount of code?
Yeah, I think in how I view it is that it's not necessarily a reduction in code.
Okay.
But it's just like, you don't just write code for the machine to run it, because then we'd all be writing assembly because it's very efficient.
Yeah.
But you also write code because it needs to be read by another programmer,
right?
Maybe you in a couple months or your colleagues. And especially since we're consultants, like we're deployed at a company for a while, and afterwards the idea is that eventually other people in the company take over.
Right.
So we want to write code that's readable and easily understandable. And I think if you do more complex operations in pandas, you tend to focus a lot on where data is stored in the data frame. Like you start slicing it, you start iterating over it. And this is something that Polars doesn't do. It's the API is way more declarative instead of like the imperative. So you just describe how you want your data end up mostly. So
yeah,
one of the big things that Polars is built on is the expressions in their API. So for example, if you want to filter, you just filter like a certain column, and you just write the condition there, and you can keep chaining it with other transformations that you do afterwards. And this makes it a lot more natural to read just top to bottom. And
yeah.
I think especially with how it's a bit comparable with, for example, PySpark as well. You have like with the with columns especially, but also select, group by, join, other operations. And then in that you have all the expressions that make it easily readable to see what's happening over there.
I come from SQL and then kind of got into R briefly as I was working in that shop that was kind of both, and I was working in both. So I had the experience of working in the tidyverse a little bit. And one thing that I really liked about it was that I could think in it very easily and do what you're talking about, the idea of chaining and sort of piping things into other things. And that is something I really like about Polars. And it definitely feels in a similar way. And I feel like SQL's a little bit like that. It's slightly clunkier. But I like the idea of also like it's just grabbing the data that you need in that sense. Because often when creating data frames with pandas, you're grabbing kind of too large of a chunk and not sitting in memory for then you to like have to like whittle it down to the stuff that you need. And the idea is kind of a little bit in reverse here is what you're saying. Like we can write this thing and then it will optimize it and just grab the stuff that it needs. Am I getting that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you're mostly describing what you want. You'd leave a lot of the optimizations up to the Polar's engine.
Yeah.
So it just takes all the expressions and transformation that you does and just has this lazy execution model.
Yeah.
So you just build up this whole graph of all the operations you want to do. And from there, it starts to reason, which data do I actually need? Is there stuff I don't even have to read at the source? Because in Pandas, with the eager execution model, you just read the whole file.
Yes.
It goes through all the transformations. And at the end, you decide to filter like a couple columns that were never needed.
Yeah.
You did all the transformations on it. So it just kept getting being pulled through this whole pipeline while it wasn't necessary. And I think a big gain in performance in the Polar's engine is that it can optimize stuff like that. And you don't have to think about it.
Yeah. As you've worked on the book, kind of moving to that, maybe we should talk about the title of the book. Maybe start there, and then I'll ask the question. But I'll start with this question. You know, tell me the title of the book and kind of like, why did you decide to write it? Like, how did that come about?
I'm going to hand that one to Jeroen.
Okay.
All right, here we go. So let's start with the title then.
Yeah.
Before I forget. I don't believe I've ever explained this, but the title should obviously have Polar's in it.
Right,
because that's what we're going to talk about. Now, Polar's itself is written in Rust with bindings available in various languages, of which the most mature one is the Python one.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's also the most used one. And so we didn't want to write about everything related to Polar's, right?
Okay.
It's a very practical book. And you sometimes have these books, I believe Spark does this, Spark the Definitive Guide, where they have Python, Java, and Scala code examples. Now, I didn't want to do that.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So I thought, okay, we're going to narrow it down to just Python Polar's. And then I wanted this to be the book. And I knew there were already some other definitive guides with O'Reilly. And so I just said, you know what? If we're going to do this, let's do it. let's do it well, right? So it became Python Polar's The Definitive Guide.
And then you pitched it as that idea to
O'Reilly. At that point? That's indeed, okay. It's all related. I was going to have a meeting with my editor at O'Reilly anyway. I had previously written data science at the command line, right, a couple of years back. And we were going to have a chat about, is there something else that I can do? Maybe a training. Or something else. And that's when I asked about Polar's. Were they aware of this thing called Polar's?
Yeah.
And well, not so much. They hadn't heard too much about it, but they had already received 4 proposals for a book.
There you go.
Which they all rejected. And so I thought like, oh, wow. So we're not the only ones with an idea there, with that idea.
Yeah.
But apparently O'Reilly, They want something that is really convincing. So to take a step back, why did we decide to write the book in the first place?
Yeah.
When I tried out Polar's for the first time, I immediately knew that this was going to be big. And I was like, this deserves a book. And I didn't really want to write it. So I first tried to convince Richie Fink, right, creator of Polar's, but he was not interested. And maybe for the better.
He's got other stuff to do.
Definitely had other stuff to do and still does. And I'm happy. I think everybody should be happy that he actually did. He continued to focus on the package and the company, Polar's Inc. itself.
Yeah.
And I think that's where also his strength is. And so then I'm like, all right, I'll do it. But I don't want to do it alone. I need someone else to help me with this. And that's when I...
Another victim.
Exactly.
Nice.
And that's... And so Thijs and I, we just started working at our client, Alianda. And that's when I reached out to him like, hey, do you want to do this together? You'll be famous. You'll be rich. It'll only take a year. And so now here we are 2 years later. We're not that rich yet, and we're not
all promises kept
that famous just yet, but there is a book.
Yeah.
It's gonna come, right?
It's gonna come. Yeah.
Well, you kind of mentioned that you did not want to have to write this thing entirely yourself. I guess have is kind of a weird word to use there, but
yeah.
You thought it would be useful to have a collaborator.
Oh yeah, definitely.
What were some of the advantages of having a collaborator here?
Oh yeah, it's when you're working together with someone, you have someone to bounce ideas off. You have someone you can share the work. I mean, writing is a very lonely process. It's a process that takes a very long time.
Yeah.
You can, it's a daily grind and it's hard. And especially when it's a topic, when the book is about a topic that you don't necessarily have any influence on, right? When it's a book that really comes from you with your own ideas, it's easier to, okay, so this is going to sound a little bit negative, but not every chapter in the book was as fun to write. Not every topic is as interesting, right?
Yeah.
Topic about joining, right? Who wants to? So there have been a gazillion chapters about joining, but it's expected.
Right.
People, when they buy a book that has the definitive guide in the title, they expect that it covers pretty much the entire package, right? Holders. So you just have to do it. But
those may not be areas that you're always excited about.
No, but it's necessary.
But it needs to be covered.
Yeah. And so it's you do this to serve the reader, right? This is not so much about you, but still then you need ways to still motivate yourself. You need ways to get the work done. And then having someone to collaborate with is very valuable. We both have our strengths. Thijs is very good at getting something on the page, right? Just write, just go.
Yeah.
And I tend to think a little bit more before I do something. It's not to say that Thijs doesn't think. We'll cut this out. No, not really. But
no, that's fine. No, I get what you're saying. Yeah. The idea is that you end up having to like consider like how you want to do this, how you want to approach it, as opposed to like, let's do a first draft right away. Because I mean, there are authors that think both ways. You know, there's like somebody who has to like wander around the neighborhood, take a nice long walk, and like think about the topic and really get it down. Where somebody else can do the brain dump and get it on the page and then go, we're going to fix this through editing.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's close to what we're talking about. Okay.
And though that's the two of us.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's like, there were some times where I think Jeroen may have been struggling a little bit with how he's going to shape the chapter.
Yeah.
And I was able to give some nudges to like, just start, just like throw some stuff on the page. We can restructure later and we'll see how it turns out.
Yeah.
And the other way around, it's also when I had a chapter, I feel like it's not quite there yet, but I don't see it anymore. I've been writing this whole chapter the whole time now. And I'm going to need some like a fresh set of eyes. And then Jeroen's able to pick some stuff out.
Yeah.
I think especially towards the end of the book to get stuff consistent, because you've been writing this over the course of 2 years and with two guys. So
you
kind of have your own style, but you don't want to show that too much in a book that's supposed to be relatively consistent.
Right.
So especially at the end, one of the things that Jeroen shaped is more like a style guide. Like what's the thing that will... we can constantly look back at to see if we're doing it consistently or not.
Yeah,
and that's something that like the perfectionist side of him is really good at.
yeah. I do a lot of video stuff, and now I've kind of become the person who manages our video courses and so forth. And so I have creators that are kind of similar on both sides. Like there are people that really just want to use an editor, and they'll just sort of dump and like, okay, I'm retaking this part, or I'll just like, they'll kind of rely on the editor. And then there's people like myself who I want to present the best thing possible to the editor, and it's kind of almost pre-edited too much. It's almost, I don't want to say perfection, but it's like one of these things where I really want to make it right and make sure that I'm getting the impression right. I don't want it to leave me without that. And so I kind of feel that and I see that in different people, but in a similar way, like if you're going to have a collaborator on something like a video product, you might have like a style book. I remember the movie, 300, there was like this whole thing that had all these different visual art studios, you know, doing the graphics and stuff for it. And they had to give them a style book. It's like, this is the color palette. This is the sort of stuff. And I think something is similar in writing. Like, it's like, okay, well, this is how we like to explain stuff. And is that kind of what you mean by kind of having a style?
Yeah, exactly. Like,
overall guide. Okay, cool. When you... Some of the stuff that you mentioned, that there was some stuff that you're like, oh, I'm not as interested in covering that. What were you excited about sort of covering? like things you're like, oh gosh, I got to have this in there?
For me, we initially set out to write one chapter about expressions.
Okay.
Right? Expressions play a very central role when it comes to polars and writing polars code. And so, okay, we should have a chapter about expressions. Turned out to be three chapters, three chunky chapters. Yeah.
Like, nice.
Yeah. Okay. So close to 100 pages about just expressions. And so that was also a struggle, right? Because you promise, all right, I'll have this chapter done by then, right? You set all these deadlines along the way, which are really your friend.
Sure.
I should stress.
Yes.
But I wasn't making this deadline, right? It kept getting bigger and bigger. So that was tough. But so I wasn't really excited while I was writing it, but I started to uncover this thing called expressions and how deep of a topic it actually is, and how to structure it. That's also where you can, you know, a moment ago I said that, you know, there are some parts where you're not really passionate about or as creative, but when it comes to structuring your thoughts and putting it on a page, that's also a creative process.
Yeah.
How are you going to explain this to the reader? Once I cracked that, once I understood, okay, this is going to be the structure, or even the thing like, okay, what is the definition of an expression?
Yeah.
That is something that I've discussed at length with Richie Vink, but also Marco Gorelli, who you've had on the show.
Yeah, definitely.
So that was a really a tough exercise, but I was excited about that part being done.
Do you want to define it now? Are you comfortable?
What the definition of an expression?
Yeah.
I have to look it up. But Thijs, you can in the meantime talk about what you were excited about. maybe the NVIDIA collaboration, if you want.
Yeah, definitely one of the things. Now, so for me, my focus has been more on the technical under the hood angle of polars.
Okay.
So one of the things I really like diving into is just playing a bit more with what's the different engines that are there. And ultimately, that led me to one of the things that was created while we were writing the book, which is a GPU engine, which is like a CUDA accelerated engine.
Oh, okay.
So NVIDIA has the CUDA software platform where you can use your GPU for general computing.
Yeah.
They already had a suite of different products aimed at data scientists. So you had like a CUDEF, which is just a data frame library that runs on your graphics card. And they already created a Pandas API for that. So you can just practically change the import and all of your Pandas code just suddenly runs on your GPUs and is executed way quicker. But for Polars, it didn't quite work the same because you have the Polars engine that's in between. So you can't just swap out the API because then you're practically running CUDEF just in an eager mode. So you lack the optimizations, which is a big part of the gains.
Right.
So for this, they had kind of like a special collaboration where they plug into the Polars library. So they effectively have like an extra dependency that runs all the CUDA stuff. And that's something that the NVIDIA team developed. And the Polars team just exposes what the optimized intermediate representation looks like. And their CUDA package just takes that and starts executing it and then hands the result back to the Polars engine again. So you just stay in the Polars world, so to speak, but you just choose to put it on a different engine. And that to start writing, like I think it was Jeroen that was approached by NVIDIA that just made this and wanted to start going out into the world with it. And of course, who better to get to than the authors of the book, The Definitive Guide? So they nice. Got together with Jeroen, and Jeroen hooked me in on the meeting as well. And in the first meeting already, they were very hyped to help us and to see if we could to write an appendix about this for in the book.
Oh, okay. So it is in the book. That's good. I was going to ask.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. It's a full appendix that's written on the GPU engine. And one of the things we really wanted to do for the book is that we could play around with it ourselves, find out how it works instead of just copy pasting NVIDIA marketing material, because that's kind of feels too much like a sellout, right?
Yeah.
So we definitely wanted to play with it around ourselves. And NVIDIA was even willing to sponsor us the hardware to run benchmarks on.
Ah, see, that's what I wanted to know.
Yeah, exactly. And in collaboration with Dell, we had someone from Dell who had the PC set up and swapped out graphics cards so we can compare a different graphics card and like the computing power of them to see how it scales over a different computing power. Because one of the things I really wanted to find out was if there's like a diminishing return. If you just start stacking more computing power on it, is there like a other bottleneck in it? And that's also some of the stuff we go into in that appendix to see how it grows.
Nice. Do you got your definitive definition?
I have the definitive definition of of a Polar's expression. And it's an expression is a tree of operations that describe how to construct one or more series. And that's quite a mouthful. And of course, in the book, we unpack all of these parts and explain in great detail what that actually means. And so this is something that is missing from the online documentation. And it's something that I don't know why, but I really like to think about this. What is an expression? And there are other definitions out there, but I was never fully satisfied with them.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, there was always like some edge cases you could come up with where it didn't quite apply. So we had to work a long time on, okay, so where can we apply expressions? Kind of list it to see in what situation it's possible and kind of hold it against the definition to test it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Part of what we've experienced in teaching some of the stuff at RealPython, we've done a few different things on Polars here and there. And I've been talking about it on the show off and on. But it's this idea of like, okay, Pandas has been around for quite a while. And it's sort of the standard in the Python world, especially data science. What has been your experience of like transitioning people over? Did you have conversations about that sort of stuff as you were writing the book? Like, did you have, I don't know, test users or people kind of reading the stuff and trying to figure out like, how do we transition them over?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, of course, we have our own experience.
Yeah.
And also actually in practice, as we were converting this large code base from Pandas to Polars.
Yeah. You got these... people that are at the business that you're going to hand this code over to, right?
Exactly. At the client, other engineers, definitely. And we've spoken to many people along the way about this. And but we also had a number of technical reviewers. And one of them is Marco Gorelli. And he is a core contributor to both Pandas and Polars. So if there's one person who knows this inside and out, it's him. And so
he
read the entire book thoroughly and gave very, very good feedback, which we all were able to incorporate.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Were there things that people got stuck on? Like indexes is one of these things that I still hear people talk about because it was pounded in their brain as a Pandas concept. I always thought it was sort of funny the way Richie sort of talked about it in his initial documentation, sort of almost like a come at me, bro, you don't need indexes type of thing. What's your brain experience with that? Like, has it been easy for people to just sort of like let go of that and say, okay, well, you don't necessarily need them and here are some reasons why?
I think that for most people, the index is just a pain in the butt, right?
Yeah.
Like, okay, I do a group by. Why is there now all of a sudden, why is this in the index, right? Okay, there are arguments that you can set to prevent that. But it used to be back in the day that you would have to call reset index all the time.
Yes.
And there, some people are definitely used to having an index, right? And the special operations that it provides. But I think this is exactly the problem with indices is that they are kind of like a column, but not really. They're being treated differently. And this is also what you see with the tidyverse is they also got rid of row names there, right? So, which is in some sense the index in a Pandas data frame. And then there are some database people that are, of course, strongly believe in having an index from a performance point of view. And then there are people who rely on indexing data at certain positions. And that is something that you have to let go, right? That's you're making assumptions there about the order of your data that are actually not really helping you. It's a lot of this is, if you're used to Pandas, is unlearning some of the things that you have learned along the way.
Yeah.
And that's, of course, that takes time. But most people that we've spoken to, or yeah, nearly everybody is really enthusiastic about Polars. It's a classic saying by now is that come for the speed, stay for the API. And that's what a lot of people agree on.
Yeah. Maybe we could talk a little bit about that. Like, I'm not sure what inspired some of the syntax. I don't know if that's something you've ever spoken with Richie about, but how would you say it's changed or, you know, comparatively? I don't know. I feel it's improved in some ways. It feels a little bit more like some of the other data science libraries that I'm a little more used to comparatively, but how would you describe some of the advantages of the syntax?
I think the syntax is a big mashup of different things that were at Richie's disposal as he started designing the language. So I think it started with Pandas, and Richie just ran into some frustrations that he had with Pandas. Like, I think most notably, it's him running a pipeline and 20 minutes in, it crashing. That's, I think, a frustration most people working with bigger pipelines and Pandas have had at some point. So the whole fail early mechanism in it is something that came from that. I think the data strictness is something that he took from Rust, which is something he had been experimenting with and started writing Polars in. So Rust is extremely strict in what kind of types you have to set. And that's also something that seems restricting, but because of that, you can make certain assumptions, make certain optimizations, and it gives you get a lot back for it. So it's a trade-off that he was willing to make and seems to have paid off. And there's other more declarative API stuff, like, for example, Spark also has that. That's also being adopted into Polars.
Yeah, Spark definitely had a big influence there. Almost too big with the with columns method. I always like to.
This is Jeroen's biggest gripe with the Polars API at this point, I think.
I'm sure you can relate, Christopher, because you have been using the tidyverse as well, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And once you've used the tidyverse, you're spoiled, right? This is such a well thought out set of packages and functions that they provide. This is something that... Yeah,
it's super clean.
It is super clean.
Yeah.
And it's something that is, unfortunately, I don't think it's even possible in Python because of the language limitations, right? That's also why you don't really have a pipe operator in Python.
Yeah.
Anyway, but there's this one thing that's the with columns method. If you think of it, select, sort, group by, filter, these are all verbs. And then there's with columns, which is not a verb. And I always have to think back of how Hatley Wickham has, throughout the entire tidyverse, there are a set of principles. And there might be exceptions to this, but I believe that most functions inside the packages that are part of the tidyverse or that work well together with the tidyverse are verbs, right?
Yeah.
And I cannot convince Richie to change this. I don't know how. I've really tried, but I've discussed this with others. Okay, what would be a good alternative for this? But there's always some argument for not using some verb. We've discussed mutate. We've discussed assign, which Pandas has, by the way.
Yeah.
But hey, I mean, that's also and that's fair. I mean, it's good that Richie doesn't just listen to everybody and changes the API on a whim. Right, there's something to say for having a benevolent dictator for this project too. Yeah. So,
yeah.
But at the same time, I think like he's opinionated on a lot of things, but there's also he's very much open to reasonable things. I think it was like during the writing of our book, we of course very very finely combed through the whole API and found some inconsistencies. And he was also open to just adding a couple of methods because they should be there and they were missing for now and just not something that popped up while they were writing it.
Okay.
And I think that's also he was very open to implementing that.
Yeah.
These are things that you were thinking about, like why doesn't it have this stuff? This is stuff that I see in other packages. Is that kind of what you meant?
Yeah, and I think there was like, for example, in the expression space, there were some bitwise operators.
Yeah.
I think Jeroen found an inconsistency in that.
There was no inline operator for the XOR operator, which is, of course, super niche, right? Who would ever think of this? But when you put things in the table, when you organize things, that's when you start, you know, identifying gaps. Like, hey, wait a minute. We have inline operators for OR and NOT, but there's not one for XOR. And also related to this, the NOT method used to be called isNOT, which is, well, and they all agreed that shouldn't be the case. But these are the kind of things that you'll notice when you write, because then you can look at things from a higher level and organize them.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. We didn't really go deep into it, but we've sort of touched on this idea of lazy versus eager. And I try to, if I can, for my audience, break some of this down. Obviously, I've talked about this a little bit on the show before, but if somebody's just coming into it, what are some important concepts that somebody has to take with this idea of switching between this concept of an eager workflow versus a lazy workflow?
Yeah, so I think the eager workflow is optimal if you're iterating on steps and you need to see intermittent results.
Okay.
So often when I'm just exploring a data set, you're just toying with it, right? You're just mutating it a little bit and doing some aggregations, and you just want to see, okay, what do I have now and what's the next step? That's the perfect way to do, it's perfect to do that with eager.
Okay.
But the moment you need the performance gains, or it's just that you start writing it in a pipeline, it's all set in stone, and you don't need the intermittent results anymore, that's like the default should be to work in lazy.
Okay.
And that's because you just get so much optimization for free.
So in some ways, it'd be like if you were working in a version of a REPL or maybe even notebook,
yeah,
you're sort of doing data exploration, sort of figuring things out. It's like, okay, well, I'll be eager here and I'll pull in a certain amount and do my sort of experiments with it. But now that I want to put it further and further toward production, I'm going to be looking at lazy and having it do this optimal versions of what I've created.
Exactly. And that's definitely also how I've been developing at that client. As you go through the steps, you've got like the pandas data frames on one side, and you're just developing to get comparable results at the other side. So you do that eager in a notebook, you just put something together. And as you want to start bringing it into production, you move it to a script and you clean it up and you turn it, you make it lazy.
Yeah. And I guess it's good to mention there that most of the time, syntax-wise, there's not much you have to change, right? If you're reading, let's say you're reading in CSV, if you use pl.read_CSV, that's eager. But if you switch that with pl.scan_CSV, that's when you start with a lazy frame. And then at the very end, you have to call the collect method to materialize the lazy frame into a data frame. Now, so syntax-wise, there's not much, it's relatively easy, right? I think there is one pitfall, and that's sometimes it is important that you cache intermittent results. So sometimes we've had situations where if we wanted to do everything in lazy, it would actually be slower than eager, because sometimes the certain computations would have to be, would then be computed twice, would have to be performed twice. And that's when you need to first cache, in quotes. So meaning collect them, store those intermediate results, and then continue being lazy again. It's a bit abstract.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, for example, the case.
Yeah. It's a bit abstract now.
Yeah.
If you just start working from one frame, load it from like the source files that you want, do a couple of transformations, and from there start creating like two different frames.
Okay.
Then if you keep it lazy all the way, then you collect the first frame and it starts running the whole pipeline from the beginning. And if just in that first bit before it splits into the two routes, so to say, then the calculation will be done twice. So it's way better to just save the frame, turn it into a data frame instead of a lazy frame, just collect it there.
Okay.
And from there, afterwards, you can very quickly swap back to the lazy API for the rest of the pipeline. You just add .lazy. As a function.
Yeah.
And then it's swapped to the lazy API again. You start building this graph instead of executing everything. And then you can call collect again.
Okay.
And also for the other side. So that helps keep stuff in the pull stuff into memory and keep the intermittent result there so it can be reused for different branches of your calculation.
I can imagine for most listeners, this sounds a bit abstract, right? What you just described was a lot of hand waving. And
yeah,
this can be tough to grasp. if people are interested, we already described this in the very first chapter of the book.
Okay.
And we've made that first chapter available for free. So if you just want to learn about this concept and see a practical example of this caching mechanism that we just described,
okay,
then yeah, you can download the first chapter for free on polarsguide.com, right there. I said it. So hope that helps.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah, that's literally where I was headed, was to ask you, like, where can people kind of discover this? And was this something that you were describing in the book? And that makes sense to me, because this seems to be a trend a lot of authors are kind of cluing in on now, where a common thing that happened in a lot of computer science books, in my opinion, is that they would explain everything that everything could do. And it's like this kind of like dictionary thesaurus encyclopedia kind of approach, where like everything is here.
Yeah.
And then you have to sort of like be the navigator to figure out, well, what's important to me, versus like kind of a problem solving approach where like, here is a problem, this is how this thing helps you with it and solve it. So I really think that's awesome that the first chapter gives you some tangible stuff to kind of check out, and then also brings up the situation where, well, you're not going to always be able to maybe do this thing depending on what you're going to do. So that I think that's really nice.
Yeah.
Is that throughout the book?
Yeah. So one of the things we try to focus on is with keeping in mind that it's a definitive guide and the functionality yeah. should be kind of listed. We also wanted to bring more than just write the API reference again, right? So
right.
We write with a lot of smaller examples, so it's easy to spot what a function does, but also some chapters at the end have more like a case. So you can see, okay, so we'll just write up an example data set and we start creating so we have this assignment to do. How are we going to get there? And we show some examples, multi-step. We've got some visualizations. There's a specific chapter on visualizations that uses different tools and different ways of visualizing the data. So we really try to focus on making it more than just a table with functions and this is what it does.
Yeah. Well, I've seen those books in my past, you know, having gone through them. So that's great.
Yeah.
It's time to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. And it digs into many of the same topics that we're covering this week. The course is titled Working with Python Polars. And it's based on a written tutorial by Harrison Hoffman. And your video instructor is my frequent co-host, Christopher Trudeau. And he takes you through why Polars is so performant and attention-grabbing. How to work with data frames, expressions, and contexts. How to read data into data frames, how to group and aggregate data, and what the lazy API is, and how to build lazy queries. Polars is a high-performance data frame library designed to provide fast and efficient data processing capabilities. I think this course will be a worthy investment of your time, especially if you're working with large data sets that might not fit into memory, or if you're just looking to speed up your Python data processing code. Real Python video courses are broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, include code examples for the techniques shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. One of the interesting things that has been a topic, and I brought it up with Wes McKinney when he came on to talk about kind of the newer generations of pandas, is this idea of, you know, that platform was built on NumPy, which was really specific about the data types it had, and it was very, you know, its name is NumPy. It was definitely idea for numbers and so forth. Now we're dealing with like these ideas of data frames that are being used for like what I was doing, which is marketing. You know, the majority of it was like strings and stuff like that. So what is kind of under the hood there? Is that something that Richie thought about as far as like designing this thing, as far as like, well, what type of data should we have in here and the data types that are inside of it?
Yeah.
How did that come apart and what's being used?
Yeah, I think that's definitely one of the things that Richie wanted to zoom in on, because one of the big performance either gains or losses is the way you represent your data in memory. And that is effectively what Wes built after he moved on from Panda. So he created Arrow,
yeah,
which is a specification of how certain data types are saved into memory. with a specific focus on analytical engines. So that was already on the shelf, and it was a no-brainer for Richie to start building on top of that for Polars. It's standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah, yeah, it's great. Yeah, it's. I've been kind of talking about it for a little while with a variety of people, and I think this sort of aero revolution is really nice.
Absolutely.
And I like that it's open, you know, that it's not like this, like the idea, hey, let's let everybody have this performance across all these data science platforms.
Yeah, I love that. Like, and one of the added advantages is that it gets even easier to switch to different libraries. You have like zero copy because it's, the layout and memory is already the same.
Yeah.
Or you can even switch between languages. So you can pass your data set to a different language and continue there. Because one of the problems we had at our client was that you have something in R in data table, then you copy it through RPy2 to a pandas data frame, but you kind of have it double in memory.
Yes.
And at one point we also copied it from pandas to polars, and pandas didn't support arrow at that time. So you have it like in memory thrice. And if you do that with a data set of like 100, 200 gigabytes, it just balloons up. It's crazy.
Right. Yeah, you just literally run out of memory.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is one kind of interesting change, and it has to do with not things, the NANs and the nulls in polars. And what's the difference there in polars?
All right. I'll take this one. Yeah. So, I mean, it relates to what you said earlier, Christopher, that Pandas is built on top of NumPy and had to come up with its own string data type. And that led to a variety of ways to represent missing data.
Yeah.
And we had not a number and not a date. And there was, I cannot even remember all the variations.
I think the Python none, you had just the empty string.
Yeah.
I think it was because it was a mashup of, you had like the floats that were in NumPy. And I think strings, of course, couldn't be represented like that, so it became Python objects, and then so it was like this mishmash of different memory layouts, and that made it very hard to have just one representation of like what's missing data. And because technically a num, another number, is a mathematical operation that just doesn't result in a number, like dividing by zero, for example.
Yeah.
Or if you start like it's just a mathematical operation that doesn't work, but it's not missing data.
Yeah.
Because there was data there, it's just it can't be represented as a number. So
it didn't turn different. Out.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's wherefore I think in Arrow you have like a whole validity layer, which is, it just has bits for all the memory slots, whether it's a null or not, whether it's missing or not, which already allows you to make a lot of optimizations just with null counts. You just go through the different buffer.
Yeah.
And you can just count the bits in there instead of having to go through all your string data and see what's there, because strings are weird because they have variable length. So you have to kind of keep where does this string start and end, and then from there start reading into it. Like it gets very complicated very fast.
Yeah.
But just keeping count, okay, so which value is null and which isn't, it's easier.
Yeah. And so in polars, there are only two possible values. I mean, they're either missing, so null, or invalid data, NA. Right? And that's also okay. In the methods that are available to you. It's just those two. So that makes it a lot easier to work with.
And that's kind of building on top of the PyArrow in a way?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We didn't dive too deep into benchmarking, but that was something that you got into. You were looking at, you know, the NVIDIA, and were you using any kind of special tools inside that? Were there any projects that you said, oh, this is what I would use for, you know, looking at the performance differences and the changes?
Yes. So there's a relatively standardized benchmark, which is called the TPC-H.
Okay.
I forgot the exact consortium it stands for, but it comes down to like there's 22 queries that you do on an analytical data set. And
okay,
those queries can be written in any library you fancy. And this is something that the Polars team had already created. So this is something we, the repo we could adapt to run more benchmarks. And like, the only thing I adapted on is practically the script that calls those queries.
Okay.
And it allowed us to make a fair comparison between different libraries to see how it's doing, but also the different library or the different engines of Polars to see how it compares to different ones.
Nice. One other thing that I thought was interesting, I'm not sure where I found all this information, but I was thinking about this idea of where you were, you know, advantages to looking at joining like a Discord community what are advantages that you found in using that? Was that during the writing of the book?
Yeah, very, very early on, we decided that we wanted to involve the community in this.
Okay.
Because there was already a very lively community at Polar's Discord server going on with very... with everybody developing Polar's, very knowledgeable users, and we just had to be a part of that. So in return, we frequently shared drafts of the book with them as well, and without any expectations, of course, but some of them, you know, became our technical reviewers and gave us feedback.
Yeah.
And but this community at Discord has been growing quite rapidly, I should say, over the course of writing the book. And being part of that was crucial, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, it's magical what some of those guys can do with Polar. It's just the, like, combinations of expressions and functions that you hadn't thought about. It's crazy. I think at one point we were chatting with Richie.
Yeah.
And Richie said that the guys on that Discord server were more effective with Polars than he could be, even though he wrote the thing, even though he wrote the whole library.
Yeah, they're out there playing with it while he's building it, which is kind of wild.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Would you suggest if someone was, you yourself, would you use a similar approach if you were writing a new book? Would you like try to find a community to look at and communicate with in the future?
Yeah, I can definitely recommend that. It's just, it's always good to, when you end up with some questions or some niche things, to just throw it into the group.
Yeah.
And Richie was kind enough to give us our own channel, so we could just ask people specific questions to the book. Or if we just threw questions in there, people could jump in and try and help us out. And it was also a channel to communicate back to say, like, hey, we finished a draft. We would like to share it with you. So that's it's perfect.
Yeah. I can imagine that it still can be scary to, you know, develop or write out in the open.
Yes.
Right? The book isn't necessarily open source, right? You kind of just get everything. It's not the entire book is put on GitHub, for example. But we, like I said, were able to share drafts, early drafts of the book. And while that was, you know, of course, a terrifying thing to do, is like, okay, what are people going to think? It is...
Right. I think you get into grammar Nazi territory.
Well, yeah. That's a possibility, but also like how you approach certain things. But if you consider the alternative, it's like, okay, wait until the very end, and then you just release your project or your book, and then give people the opportunity to look at it and give feedback. That's actually much scarier. So I can always recommend it. If it is possible, is to develop and write out in the open, become part of the community.
Yeah. Are there things that we didn't dig into that you want to share about the book that you feel like these are important things that people should know if they're interested in learning more about Polars?
I don't know. If people go to the website of the book, they'll be able to see for themselves what they think of it, especially since you can download the first chapter for free. You can read what others think of the book.
Okay.
Yeah, but you know, other than that, a book is only as good as what you do with that new knowledge, right? So our recommendation is always try to apply that new knowledge as soon as possible, come up with something interesting to work on.
Yeah, and I think we also invested into, like, there's a lot of code examples in the book.
Yeah.
And we also made a GitHub repo so you can just follow along.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good.
And one of the things I would definitely recommend is play with it. It's like, even don't just run the code cells and look at the results, because those are also printed in the book. Just play around, see if you can mix it with some other expressions, get some other outcomes, and just see what happens.
Yeah.
Nice.
And if I can plug something related to Posit.
Yeah.
I've been involved recently with the Tidy Tuesday project. Christopher, have you ever heard of Tidy Tuesday as an R user?
Yeah, I tried to champion it a little bit here because I'm always looking for like data and stuff for people to play with. And this idea of having, you know, some projects. So what was the name? I'm sorry, was it Tidy or what was it?
So the original project, right, for the R community is Tidy Tuesday.
Yeah.
Right? Sounds good. Tidy Tuesday.
Yes.
And, you know, not too long ago, Posit started the Pidy Tuesday project, right?
Okay.
Pi for Python. And so it is every week there's a new data set being uploaded.
Nice.
And people are invited to to explore it, to try out tools or refine their skills on this data without any commitment necessary. Just low-key, try out new things.
Right.
I find that that'll also be a good opportunity to hone your skills and to try out, you know, for example, to learn something new.
Yeah.
And that you could do that, you know, for polars or some data visualization library that you've come across. It's a great opportunity if you cannot come up with a project of your own.
Yeah. It's one of the problems I have with some of the books that have been written about other data frame type of tools is very often it was just literally like, let's generate a bunch of numbers and have a bunch of letters. And it's like, oh my God, this is the worst data I've ever seen as far as wanting to work with it.
Yeah.
It has no context in the real world.
No soul.
It doesn't have a story at all. It's just like, it's like the foo and bar of computer science. Yeah. I don't like those as terms either. And so I try to champion these types of things. So that's great. I wasn't aware that it had been, that there's as this sort of offshoot of Pi.
Yeah.
PyD Tuesday.
Yeah.
So I'll definitely include links for that if you'll send them to me.
Will do.
I think that'll be great.
Yeah.
I have these weekly questions I like to ask everybody who comes on the show. And so the first one is, what's something that you're excited about that's happening in the world of Python?
I think for me, it's something that's been the movement that we have been seeing is in general that performance has become a feature.
Yeah.
So you see a lot of the Rust-based tools that really dive into optimizing performance, and it can be game-changing. We said, like, one of the examples I'm the most hyped about is Astral.
Yeah.
And what Charlie Marsh has been doing with his team, because what started with Ruff and now UV and I hope soon Ty, their static type checker.
Yeah.
Is that, like, with stuff like UV, you can now suddenly run a self-contained Python script. You just, I think it was 7.2.3, the Python right. enhancement
yeah.
plan.
Inline metadata, yeah.
Where you have the inline dependencies that you can do. And you just UV run the script and it just pulls everything together. It's also something we very quickly switched to for the repo next to our book, because just typing UV sync instead of having to get the right Python version and then find the dependencies and we work with the requirements file, like it's tough.
That's great.
So UV just solves so many problems.
Well, you answered a question that I seem to have missed that I had on my list here, which is like, why did you guys choose UV? And it's like, boom, right there. So that's great. Thanks. So what's your answer? What are you excited about in the world of Python?
Yeah, for me, it's also related to PEP 7.23, and that is command line tools. I mean, I'm of course biased. I wrote a book about it a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I got a book about it.
So recently, you know, you see all these command line interfaces for Claude and Codex coming out, and it seems that command line interfaces are more popular than ever. And with PEP 7.23, you can make these in Python very easily, as in the management around them, because this new syntax, right, allows you to define your dependencies in the script itself, making it self-contained.
Yeah.
At PyData London, we recently gave a tutorial about creating a command line tool in Python, and the room was packed. And it's just so good to see that there is still so much enthusiasm about this. And I think that's not going away anytime soon. And seeing other companies come out with command line interfaces is, sparks joy.
Yeah, yeah. It's been a repeating theme, yeah.
And as we're talking about this, the other one that popped up for me is Marimo.
Yeah. So
instead of the Jupyter notebooks with their hidden state. Oh,
yeah.
Just having Marimo, which is just output as a script and just rerun cells automatically. Just these tiny few irritations I've had with Jupyter have been resolved in Marimo. And I believe, Jeroen, you also recently met with Vincent, who now works at Marimo, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. We recorded a video about a Quarto plugin that they had created. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, I'm excited about that project. I had Akshay on, and it was really fun to talk to him about it. And he's been listening to the show and occasionally like correcting me about certain things, which I thought was really funny. We were talking about like using numbers in it and how it has a version of the GitHub Markdown that includes like this, you know, symbol stuff for LaTeX inside of it, which is really nice. So you can, you know, have your Markdown mathematical stuff look all nice and pretty and so forth. So the next one is, what do you want to learn next? This doesn't have to be about programming. It could be anything else in your life that you want to learn.
So one of the things is because I saw this whole polyglot wave of the Rust-Python combination, one of the things I've been getting into is Rust, just get back a bit more to the strict languages, a bit more to dive into the performance, to become polyglot in that sense.
That used to be one of the most common answers to that question.
Yes. I'm late to it, it seems.
It's changed a little bit lately, not in a bad way, but what I want to ask you as a follow-up then is, there was a particular book that everybody was referencing back at that time. Are there certain resources that you're using to learn it?
So one of the first steps, because I'm just dipping my toes in it now.
Yeah.
One of the first things I did was ask Gemini Pro, the 2.5 model, So what's the features that really set Rust apart? And explain this to me in a paragraph, give me an example that shows it, and then afterwards create an exercise that with a run-on example that keeps popping back through all these things. And it just gave me a whole introduction tutorial to Rust, spit it out. It's like it's way too long as well, which I love because normally they're quite concise in their responses, but this became like a whole tutorial.
Cool.
And then in addition to that, I also asked to include some of the PyO3 binding so I can easily hop between Python and Rust.
Yeah. Nice. That's great.
But there's definitely also a bunch of books, of course. I still have.
Oh, yeah. Totally. No, but it's interesting. I think that's a neat approach as far as a way to look at, you know, using some of these new tools to help you learn and not necessarily skip the part where you are actually learning it and it's just doing it for you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so the doing it makes it different for me because I started with like the Rust handbook that you can find online.
Yeah.
But then you're just reading it. So if you don't really have something to tag along and just actually start doing things, it doesn't really land as well. So that's why I just looked into, let's just try this first and then maybe hop to and from the handbook and get through it.
Yeah, yeah. Yarun, what's something that you want to learn next?
Japanese. I would love to.
Ah.
Yeah, but I'm afraid that it will take me, that it will take too much of my time. But I just...
I studied it for a while. I was moving to Hawaii. My wife grew up there. And I thought it would be helpful to be able to speak it because there's a large contingency. In fact, I worked at a bank there that was actually the Japanese bank, which was interesting. After World War II, nobody would allow them to get bank accounts or have their own, banking institutions. So they decided to start their own.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting. So, but I didn't really meet that many people that really wanted to speak it with me.
Yeah.
It's kind of like going to France. Have you ever done that? Like where you go to like another country and they're like, oh, don't try any more tourists.
the French are very picky about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Japanese might be a little friendlier about it, but
definitely
the hardest part for me was the multiple written formats. Yeah. It was like, oh,
hiragana, katakana, kanji.
This is hard.
Yeah.
Well, good luck with that. That sounds fun.
Thank you. I'm currently exploring what method I should use. Pimsleur, Duolingo, there are various options. Others just say,
I did some Pimsleur.
What do you recommend? Yeah.
Pimsleur is good for speaking it and being able to walk around and so forth, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I got pretty far in that system. And then the other one that...
Genki?
What's the one called? Rosetta Stone. That I felt was useful in the sense that it helped with the writing. It was at least good at sort of challenging with that sort of stuff.
All right. It's good to hear. I open to suggestions.
Cool. Sure. I guess the last question is, I guess could be before both of you here jointly, what's the best way that people can follow your guys' work online?
I think the best way is to keep in touch with the website.
Okay.
So with polarsguide.com. That's where we'll keep updating if we create additional resources, if there's any big updates that we want to write additional blogs about, for example.
Yeah.
And that's where you can get the sample chapter and... Yeah, there's like there's our author bios, there's links to the social media where we're active as well. So it's pretty much the hub that we try to keep up to date with any stuff around the book.
Nice. Is there anything else you want to add there, Yuri?
No, sorry. I just wanted to interrupt Dice. That website is a good start because it links to everything else. You'll be able to find us and
Great. Hey, it was fantastic to talk to both of you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
Likewise. Thanks for having us.
I really want to thank Jeroen and Thijs for coming on the show this week. And I want to thank you for listening to the Real Python Podcast. Make sure that you click that follow button in your podcast player. And if you see a subscribe button somewhere, remember that the Real Python Podcast is free. If you like the show, please leave us a review. You can find show notes with links to all the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.